Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Wednesday, April 17th. It's becoming high season at the Supreme Court and high season for criminal trials involving defendant Donald J. Trump. Between now and June, the Supreme Court will decide on landmark cases from the legal status of the abortion pill, mifepristone, to whether presidents have immunity from prosecution, no matter their attempts at insurrection or any other crime. They'll decide on the limits of power of federal agencies to make rules based on acts of Congress. That could be the most important case you've never heard of, called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, we'll discuss. They just decided on Monday that a ban on gender-affirming care for trans teenagers by the state of Idaho can mostly take effect. That ban left in place, at least for now, while the underlying case continues to be argued. And yesterday, the justices heard oral arguments in a case that could throw out hundreds of January 6th-related convictions of people who invaded the Capitol, who juries found guilty of a law that makes it a crime to obstruct or impede an official proceeding, including a congressional proceeding. Justice Neil Gorsuch expressed skepticism of those convictions in this question about how serious an act has to be classified as obstruction.
Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify or at the State of the Union address?
We'll hear more excerpts from yesterday's hearing, including the response to Gorsuch's question there from United States Solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger, who represented the Justice Department. And joining us for this is University of Pennsylvania Law Professor Kate Shaw. She is also co-host, as some of you know, of the Supreme Court-oriented podcast Strict Scrutiny, with two other constitutional law professors, Leah Littman and Melissa Murray. And Kate Shaw is a New York Times and ABC News contributor. Kate, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Let's dive right in on yesterday's hearing that could reverse about 350 January 6th-related convictions. Before we hear more excerpts, can you explain the law in question? A lot of people don't know what this is. I understand it's a relatively new law inspired by the Enron accounting fraud scandal of 2002, yes?
That's exactly right. And maybe I'll just say a little bit about the defendant in the case, Joseph Fisher, and then talk about the statutory kind of context under which the charge was brought. So he was one of the January 6th defendants, a former police officer involved in storming the Capitol on January 6th. And the federal government amassed a great deal of evidence that seemed to suggest that he did intend to cause harm and to disrupt the proceedings of Congress. So he has text messages suggesting that it might get violent. That is the events, the protests on January 6th, the storming of the Capitol. He has a separate text message in which he says it's going to be historic. Take Democratic Congress to the gallows. Can't vote if they can't breathe. So all this evidence, the federal government said, very clearly established that he went to the Capitol determined to interfere with, obstruct the official proceeding, which was, of course, the proceeding on January 6th to count and certify the final electoral vote for Joe Biden as president. So he was charged with a number of crimes, but among them was the crime that you just alluded to, Brian, 18 U.S.C. Section 1512 C2. I won't get too technical, but basically it's a provision that prohibits obstructing an official proceeding. It carries a 15-year maximum sentence, but, you know, most of the January 6th defendants convicted under this provision have gotten more like 1 or 2 years. And on its face, the language, just obstructing, influencing, or impeding any official proceeding, does seem to clearly cover this kind of conduct, right? Storming the Capitol to prevent the certification of votes as part of an official proceeding. But what Fisher is arguing is basically that the law doesn't apply to him, both because this part of the law that he was charged under has to be understood in light of the preceding provision of law that's about document destruction, but also because of the context in which Congress passed the law. And that's what you just mentioned, Brian. So this law was passed in 2002. It was part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and it was a response to Enron and Arthur Andersen and this, you know, accounting scandal, which involved a lot of evidence destruction. And he says that's really what the statute is about, like shredding documents, not storming a government building. And for that reason, it was inappropriate to charge me under this statute.
According to Nina Totenberg's report on this case on NPR, One part of the law makes it a crime to corruptly alter or destroy documents. You just referred to the documents provision, documents mm-hmm. or records related to an official proceeding. And the second part makes it a crime to otherwise obstruct or impede an official proceeding, including a congressional proceeding. So, as you say, this defendant was not accused or convicted of destroying documents per se. Given the vagueness of that second part, if that's the actual language, otherwise obstruct or impede an official proceeding, I could see why theoretically Justice Gorsuch might have asked that question about where the line is. If the law makes it a crime in general language to obstruct or impede a proceeding, what constitutes obstructing or impeding? Is that part of the law unusually vague?
I actually don't think it is, right? Obstructing, influencing, or impeding any official proceeding just on its face does seem to suggest, at the very minimum, storming the seat of government and trying to block the official certification of electoral votes, which is both in the Constitution and in federal statute. But I do think you're right that what Gorsuch and Alito in particular were pressing on was the potential breadth of the coverage of the statute. So maybe if it's a crime, you know, if the storming of the Capitol was a crime and this language is read literally, maybe that does suggest it could be a crime to interrupt arguments at the Supreme Court, to heckle the president during the State of the Union, to engage in protest outside, of a district courthouse in a way that might make it difficult for proceedings to unfold in a normal way. So they were a little bit probing the outer boundaries of the statute. But I thought the Solicitor General, I think, was quite effective in responding and suggesting what you need to have is a lot of evidence, and the federal government will only charge if there is a lot of evidence that the individual intended to obstruct an official proceeding, right? Protesting outside of a government building is not the kind of thing that's going to result in this kind of mass of evidence that you had in a case like this one and in a lot of the other January 6th cases. But the kind of outer boundaries of the statute does seem to be what the justices were concerned about. But, you know, it was a little bit hard to swallow, I think, that concern in that just I actually do think the text of the statute, obstructing, influencing, impeding any official proceeding, isn't vague. It might be broad, but the federal government had a lot of arguments about the way that the actual practice of prosecutions under the law really narrows the broad language. But I think it's actually pretty straightforward, and I do think that it's plain that it applies to the kind of conduct that was charged here.
So here are a couple of more clips from the oral arguments yesterday that go to that argument. You mentioned Samuel Alito. Here's another version of that same question that we heard from Gorsuch, posed this time by Justice Alito.
Let's say that today, while you're arguing, five people get up and they shout either keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail or free the January 6th patriots. Our police officers have to remove them forcibly.
And here's part of the answer by Solicitor General Prelogar about the standard the Justice Department used for actually prosecuting January 6th obstruction of an official proceeding cases.
We have focused on things like preparation for violence, bringing tactical gear or paramilitary equipment to the Capitol.
So that kind of goes to the point that you were making, Kate. But is the Solicitor General there trying to make a distinction between merely, say, protesting an official proceeding and attempting to violently stop it from taking place?
Absolutely. And I do think that, so you've now played clips from Justice Gorsuch, Justice Alito, actually Justice Thomas's very first question, suggested that said so I think what Thomas said was, has the government applied this provision to other protests in the past, right? So trying to characterize January 6th, or at least the question seemed to posit that January 6th might be understood as an incident of protest. And I think what the Solicitor General was suggesting very strongly in response was that the federal government does not charge individuals engaged in ordinary and peaceful protest with violation of this statute. And by its terms, they couldn't. And she did say later in the argument, if in fact what, you know, the conduct at issue was political speech, then the First Amendment protects that speech. So in the event that the federal government brought such a charge, which it's clear they never have, there would be a very viable First Amendment defense to that charge. So I think that takes care of many of the scenarios that the justices like Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch were positing as hypotheticals. But I do think that the tenor of those questions and some of the questions from Justice Kavanaugh as well did suggest that there's real concern on the part of some of the justices about, you know, whether these charges were proper, whether the convictions that were already secured under them could be sustain. So, you know, what's at stake here is not just this charge against this January 6th defendant, but several hundred charges against other January 6th defendants. Now, with Fisher, I should say, you know, again, given the extensive evidence of planning and violent intent and actions, right, there's some videotape of some of his activities on January 6th. He was actually charged with violating a number of federal statutes. This was just one of them. But this is the only question that's before the court, whether this charge can be sustained.
Yeah. So it makes it kind of a weird case to my mind, because this particular individual, if I'm understanding it correctly, was charged with and convicted of more serious things like assault, in addition to obstructing an official proceeding. So he's not going to get off just by winning this case at the Supreme Court. Am I understanding that correctly?
I think as to him, there are other charges. I mean, I think that what the federal government does think it's really important that the court not, you know, adopt this or not embrace this challenge, in part because, you know, there are something like 330 defendants charged under this particular statute of the, you know, 1,300 total that were arrested for playing some part in the attack on the Capitol. But for many of the individuals, not Mr. Fisher, the only other charge was a trespassing charge, which is often a misdemeanor charge. So this is the only serious offense with which they are charged. And so if this is wiped away, then people who engaged in, I think, very serious misconduct in, you know, the views of the federal government, right, trying to disrupt something that goes to the very heart of democracy, right, the peaceful transfer of power, and a misdemeanor trespassing charge doesn't seem to capture the gravity of the conduct. But this obstruction charge, which can carry a heavy penalty, although, again, there's a 15-year statutory maximum, but there's no statutory minimum. And so the sentences have been far, far below that 15 years, even though it sounds really long kind of in the abstract. And so I do think that the stakes are high as to many of these January 6th defendants in the eyes of the federal government.
And I see we have a call coming in that's not immediately related in the sense of the Supreme Court about to rule on something, but I think it really is in the bigger scheme of things. So Janet in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Law Professor Kate Shaw. Thank you so much for calling.
Good morning. I know that we all saw what happened in January at 6, but what I'm saying is these same people who are on trial would have told the police, they would have been angry if black people and brown people or their allies had done the same thing. And now when it's them, oh, no, 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 no. And I just recently heard, I think on MSNBC, that Tom Cotton was advocating that they beat up peaceful protesters. I mean, and we know that on both sides, people have done things wrong, okay? But we know that if it had been black, brown, and allies, they would have been treated very, very differently, you know? And most of America would have said, yeah, you know, they deserve to be treated that way. So that's what's infuriating. And then to hear Cotton now saying, beat up peaceful protesters who are just sitting in the street, yeah, it's an inconvenience. Yeah, it's wrong. That's what I have to say.
Thank you, Janet. And let me explain that Tom Cotton story a little bit more to our listeners. I think I probably saw the same report on MSNBC that you did. So from my understanding of that and hearing an actual Tom Cotton quote, and Professor Shaw, this is not a legal argument before the Supreme Court right now, which is your specialty, but I think it does raise relevant legal questions. Cotton apparently referred to pro-Palestinian protesters holding the kind of sit-ins that block traffic, and said because that could be a threat to people trying to take their kids to school or to emergency services vehicles trying to get through, if those protesters block a bridge or an important roadway or something like that. Cotton said individuals should take matters into their own hands and get out of their cars and physically drag those protesters off the road. And the clip I heard of Cotton, he called the pro-Palestinian sit-in protesters vigilantes. He didn't call the people who he was suggesting use physical force to drag peaceful protesters off the road. He didn't call them vigilantes. I wonder if you've seen that story at all.
Yes. And I mean, I think people were appropriately disturbed by the suggestion by a sitting senator that individuals use extra legal violence to respond to peaceful protests. And yet, sort of back to the pre-logger argument, you know, that advocacy, if, again, understood as encouraging violence, would still be squarely within the bounds of the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects a great deal so long as you are not crossing the line into actually inciting, right, taking, you know, engaging in speech that you expect to and is likely to actually cause imminent lawless action, right? It's a very high bar. So people may find the speech vile, but the First Amendment will protect it. But I think, and you know, that is, I'm not sure what specific protest he had in mind when he made that statement. But I think the point is that there's a great deal of political protest that, you know, is well within the bounds of the First Amendment, but overt action, again, with a great deal of planning and an intent to obstruct or interfere with a specific official proceeding, may, under some limited circumstances, be deemed to cross the line into criminality, at least in the view of the federal government.
Robert in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
How are you? Good morning. So, Professor, I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on the fact that it appears that yesterday, the originalist or textualist, as they like to be called, that they seem to have difficulty leaning into the apparently plain language of the statute as it related to disrupting or impeding? Like, they seem to have great difficulty with that, despite calling themselves originalists and textualists. And the other question I have for you is, what are your thoughts on the fact that Justice Thomas was sitting there yesterday? Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Kate?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as to the first, yes, I found it really striking as well. These are justices, sort of each of the Republican appointees on the court. I mean, Alito a little bit less so, and the Chief Justice a little bit less so, but all of the others are very proud, self-proclaimed textualists. They say the words of the statute are the most important thing and sometimes the only thing that matters in deciding what a statute means. And here you had, you know, maybe this statute has to be understood in light of this preceding provision of law. Maybe we should focus on the fact that it was an accounting scandal that gave rise to the statute. Much, much less focus on the words of the statute than you would expect self-identified textualist justices to be engaging in. So that a little bit goes back to our early conversation, Brian, what's really, you know, driving the justices. As to Justice Thomas's presence on the bench, you know, I do think that it's, I'm glad that you brought that, Robert, and I think it's an important, you know, an important point to continue to make, which is that there was a serious argument that Justice Thomas ought to have recused in participating in this case, in the upcoming immunity case involving former President Trump, given his wife Ginni Thomas's involvement in, you know, not presence at the Capitol on January 6th, but involvement in the events leading up to January 6th. You know, she testified before the January 6th committee and was clearly involved in discussions about the, you know, what then became the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And there were calls for him to recuse, and they fell on deaf ears. And in moments past, justices have recused for, I think, far less compelling reasons, just because they didn't want the appearance of impropriety. And it was, I think, especially striking because Thomas was actually off the bench on Monday. He didn't sit and participate in two other arguments. There was no explanation, so we don't know why. Not recusals. We don't. But we really don't know. But of course, he returned and was very active asking the first question in this case. And I think for many people, that feels scandalous, that, he, you know, it feels as though if there's a suggestion, if there's an appearance, if people might think he has, you know, a developed view and his personal, you know, connection or spousal connection to the events might impair his judgment, he ought to err on the side of caution and recuse. And clearly he's not decided to do that.
But what's the single standard when it comes to the actions of your relatives as opposed to you? I don't know your marital status, but if you had a spouse who was involved politically in some way and you were a judge, maybe you would bristle at the idea of you having to recuse yourself because of something your spouse did. We see the case in New York right now where Trump keeps disparaging the judge in that hush money case because of political activity of his daughter or his clerk. And, okay, forget the clerk. The daughter is a blood relative, and I think a lot of people would say, no, he shouldn't have to recuse himself because of that.
I think it's a good and important question, and I actually do think that family members and even spouses and their activities should ordinarily be off-limit in politics and shouldn't necessarily give rise to a conflict or an appearance of a conflict. And yet there are provisions of law that seem to take a different position. So, you know, that your spouse's income is included in your financial filings for purposes of disclosure and conflict of interest rules. So actually, the federal law in a lot of places basically does impute your spouse's finances and other activities to you. And that doesn't necessarily control in the context of a recusal decision, but I think it's kind of relevant background. But here I think, you know, there is no smoking gun evidence that Ginni Thomas and Justice Thomas discussed January 6th, but there are suggestions and allusions in some of the materials that she was required to produce in the January 6th investigation. There's a reference in a text message to having talked it over. This is the kind of talking she's texting with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows about the election. And, you know, she was quite involved in pushing the notion that there was, you know, widespread fraud, irregularity, et cetera, in the election. And she mentions having talked it over with my best friend. Many, many people have suggested that the Thomases refer to one another as their best friend. So there's at least a suggestion in a text message in the public record that she was talking about this with her spouse. Again, we don't know for sure that she was, but at least it is out there to create the impression for some. And that, again, many people think that should be enough to result in a discretionary decision, even if not a required decision, to recuse in the interest of the appearance of justice and the integrity of the court as an institution.
And in our last minute, I just want to give you a chance to put on people's radar the case that we'll hear a ruling on by the end of June that you've said is so important, called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. And people are listening and thinking, what? Loper? What? What's Bright? And who's Raimondo? So prepare us for what's at stake by the end of June with that.
Sure. And there's two cases consolidated. One is called Relentless. Maybe that's an easier one to remember. So think of it as the Relentless case, maybe. But it's really, they're really fundamentally about the power of federal agencies. And because most of what government does happens through agencies, power of the federal government to, you know, meaningfully act to regulate and protect our health and safety in all kinds of ways. So here it's a regulation about fishing, right? Who pays for a monitor on board fishing boats to prevent overfishing? But the court here may overrule a 1984 decision that for, you know, 40 years has basically given agencies power in the first instance to decide what ambiguous statutes mean. And so that has to do with everything from food safety to, you know, the storage of nuclear waste and kind of everything in between. And this decision could, I think, really disable courts from disable agencies from being able to meaningfully exercise that regulatory power and instead shift an enormous amount of power to courts and to this Supreme Court in particular. So it's a case with incredibly high stakes, well beyond this narrow question of overfishing and monitors on board boats.
University of Pennsylvania law professor Kate Shaw, also co-host of the Supreme Court-oriented podcast, Strict Scrutiny. Thank you so much for all this.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.